chapter 2. You know, brothers, that our visit to you was not a failure. We had previously suffered and been insulted in Philippi, as you know, but with the help of our God, we dare to tell you his gospel in spite of strong opposition. For the appeal we make does not spring from error or impure motives, nor are we trying to trick you. On the contrary, we speak as men approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. We're not trying to please men, but God who tests our hearts. You know we never use flattery, nor do we put on a mask to cover up greed. God is our witness. We were not looking for praise from men, not from you or anyone else. As apostles of Christ, we could have been a burden to you, but we were gentle among you, like a mother caring for her little children. We loved you so much that we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well, because you have become so dear to us. Surely you remember, brothers, our toil and hardship. We worked night and day in order not to be a burden to anyone while we preached the gospel of God to you. You are witnesses, and so is God, of how holy, righteous, and blameless we were among you who believed. For you know that we dealt with each of you as a father deals with his own children, encouraging, comforting, and urging you to live lives worthy of God, who calls you into his kingdom and glory.
Where was I?
The Didache, yeah.
Yeah. So you see those ancient Christian documents, this is how you live the Christian life, baptism, whatever it might be. So boring, though, really. Not that any of that stuff's boring, but it would be boring if we had a textbook. And what's the other problem with textbooks is that they don't allow for normal human life, do they? They don't allow for the normal mess of life. So God has ordered things so that letters were written to real churches, real people in real places. We've been looking at 1 Corinthians in the morning, haven't we? Man, those guys were crazy, weren't they? But how much is there to learn from what Paul writes to them in correcting their sin? But in the evenings, we're in Thessalonica. I was really worried about saying that word, Thessalonica, because it's a bit of a tongue twister. But it was an urban Greek port city. Probably had a population of about 200,000 at the time of Paul. So that's getting on for what? 9 or 10 times the population of Hayward's Heath, and about 50,000 extra than Brighton. Just Brighton, not Brighton and Hove, mind you. So this is quite a big place. And it was on a major trade route between Rome and what is now modern-day Turkey. So you would have seen all sorts of people in Thessalonica. You'd have seen merchant traders. You would have seen just normal Greek people. There was a whole variety of people in Thessalonica, just a very urban ancient city. And in this urban ancient city, a church has been planted. Thessalonica, or the Thessalonian church, actually got off to quite a dramatic start. You can read about it in Acts 17. Paul literally starts a riot. He comes along and he does what Paul does best. He preaches the gospel, he tells people about Jesus, and he actually is quite successful. Quite a few people come on board and believe, variety of people, Gentiles, non-Jews, and Jews. But this really upsets the religious leaders. Those guys are such a bunch of wet blankets, aren't they, really? Judaism was working really well for the religious leaders because they were the leaders. They were calling the shots. And Paul was coming along, he was going to mess all that up for them completely. So being typical religious guys, they get some thugs to do their dirty work and they set up this riot. And so Paul and his companions end up getting kicked out of Thessalonica. I keep having to say that word. So they're forced to leave this city, they have to leave it behind. I kind of feel, well, not sorry for Paul because that's what he was called to, but I'm an electrician, so I go and do jobs in people's houses, like kitchens and things, and you'll be working on a kitchen, you get it all wired up, you put all the downlights in, nice dimmable lighting, you put all the shiny sockets on, you finish the job, and you look at the kitchen, you think, oh, this is a really nice kitchen. And then you have to go. You have to leave, go home to my normal kitchen with my white plastic sockets and tiles falling off the wall. It's kind of like that for Paul, because he goes from one place to another, starts a church, and then he leaves. He has to go on to the next place. But unlike me and my kitchens, my electrical installations, well, I do care about them to a certain extent, but he doesn't just go off and forget about these churches that he plants. He really cares about the believers in these places. And he felt that way about the believers in Thessalonica, the Thessalonians. I'll stick to saying Thessalonians because that's a little bit easier. He really cared about them. He desperately wanted to get back to see them. But for some reason, he's not able to get back to them. So you see at the end of chapter 2, Paul says that Satan hindered us. He's very specific that the reason I couldn't get back to see the guys at Thessalonica is because Satan stopped me from doing so. But just think about it. If Satan hadn't hindered Paul, then we wouldn't have this letter, would we? So Satan is actually partly responsible for this book of the Bible that we have before us. You see how God works? He turns around something bad, even Satan's very schemes, God uses that for good. Paul couldn't see the big picture, but with retrospect, we can see that God's working, God's plans. Despite Satan trying to stop Paul, we've got this letter in front of us because of Satan's plan. So Paul sends the young apprentice, I always think of him as a young apprentice, Timothy. He sends him back to see these guys. And Timothy comes back and brings this report. It's actually really encouraging. It's nothing like the Corinthian church. Nobody's trying to sleep with their stepmom. People aren't getting drunk off communion wine. People aren't thinking that they're super spiritual, special people. It's actually a really encouraging church, the Thessalonian church. And Paul, he's writing to them because apparently he still couldn't get back to see them. Timothy could get to them, but Paul for some reason couldn't. So he writes this letter to them. What does he say at the beginning of chapter 1? Grace and peace to you. Paul really cared about these people. He's writing to them for their good. And we're to receive this letter to us for our good, just like it was to them. One of the interesting things about these two letters is every church has its own thing, doesn't it? Like the Corinthian church, super spirituality, crazy sins, all the rest of it. The Galatian church, they're kind of like into their legalism. You see all these different kinds of churches in the New Testament, kind of like today. But the Thessalonian church, apparently their kind of thing was eschatology. Some of you are like, eschata what? The end times, the apocalypse, Jesus coming back. I say that because Paul actually mentions it quite a few times in 1 Thessalonians. He talks about Jesus coming back. And in 2 Thessalonians as well, he talks about it quite a lot. Ever heard of the rapture? Ever come across the rapture? That whole word actually comes out of 1 Thessalonians. Ever heard of the Antichrist, the man of lawlessness? 2 Thessalonians. We're not in those passages tonight, so I'll leave that to whoever is. Maybe that's a good thing. But Paul's already started his letter off by talking about the conversion of the Thessalonians in chapter 1, these great encouragement that has come from the Thessalonians because of their faith. He's talked about the impact that they've had on those around them. They really were a great example of a church. They were brand new Christians, baby Christians, but Paul is so encouraged by them. So let's get into the verses that we're actually looking at tonight. I try and avoid having 3 points, but it always seems to be that I end up with 3 points. I don't know why. It's probably partly because of my OCD and partly because I've been brought up on a diet of 3-point sermons. So we've ended up with 3 points. And my first point is a memory shared. Let's come to verse 1. For you yourselves know, brothers, that our coming to you was not in vain. Paul's visit to the Thessalonian church was a fruitful one. It wasn't a failure. He could have easily have left the Thessalonians behind and the whole thing could have just fallen apart completely. Quite easily, couldn't it? He could have just gone there, told them the gospel gets off to a really encouraging start. All these people respond, say, yes, yes, we believe in Jesus, we believe the gospel. And then Paul goes off, and by the time Timothy gets back to see them, It's just fallen flat on its face, no church anymore. But that hasn't happened at all. It hasn't been a failure. It hasn't been in vain. It's actually been a great success. Now, Paul, before he came to the Thessalonian church, had been in Philippi. Verse 2, though he'd already suffered and been shamefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we have boldness in our God to declare to you the gospel, the good news of God in the midst of much conflict. Paul, when he turned up at Thessalonica, he would have still had the bruises on him, the cuts from the beating that he'd already got in Philippi. So Paul says to the Thessalonians, look, I have no ulterior motive here. I really do believe this. It hasn't worked out particularly well for me, actually, because wherever I go, I seem to get a beating or things seem to go wrong. There's a couple of things for us to learn there, really, isn't there? Firstly, just because you're facing opposition and conflict, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're doing the wrong thing. Paul had been very specifically commissioned by God to take the gospel message, the good news about Jesus, to the Gentiles, the non-Jews. That's what God had assigned to him. Jesus had personally turned up and spoken to Paul. Paul knew what his mission was. But as he'd set out on the mission, he experienced opposition, conflict, disappointment, difficulty. And don't we just experience that in our own lives, to whatever God's called us to? I'm sure for all of us, most of us, our calling isn't nearly as epic or groundbreaking as it was for Paul. But you do have a calling. God's called you to do something. Maybe some of us that have with different levels of clarity exactly what that is. But whatever God's called you to, don't expect it to necessarily be easy, because it wasn't for Paul, and it wasn't for Jesus, and it probably won't be for you. But don't be discouraged, because Paul wasn't. And just because you do experience opposition, difficulty, disappointment, don't think that you're not going to achieve whatever it is that God's assigned to you. Look at Paul. He's been pretty successful, actually, hasn't he? One of the most influential characters in history. Here we are reading a letter that Paul wrote. As a result of Paul's ministry, his teaching has gone forward for the past 2,000 years. I think he was a success, don't you? I think he did what God assigned to him, and he succeeded in it. At the time, it might have been very, very difficult for Paul. Far more difficult than anything that we will probably experience. But Paul achieved the goal that God had set for him. Now, Paul, he says that there's no hidden agenda for him. Unless Paul was some kind of crazy masochist who loved to get a beating, he certainly had no motivation for doing this. So, you know, there was no Facebook in those days, so he couldn't post videos of himself winding up religious people and getting beaten up for it to get a following. There was no ulterior motive for Paul. That's what he says to the Thessalonians. There wasn't really anything in it for me. He didn't manipulate them. He didn't butter them up. He didn't come in with the hard sell. He didn't give them empty promises. He simply gave them the truth. He wasn't looking to get famous. There wasn't any money to be made. And yet Paul says, my motivation, my heart motivation in preaching and teaching the gospel before God, I know that although his motivation wasn't perfect, because nobody's perfect, the motivation was a pure motivation. It was the right motivation. And despite everything that Paul had faced in Thessalonica, he could look back and remember and have a clear conscience and have no regrets. It's so easy for us to do even the right things for the wrong reasons, or to do things that have honourable end goals, but to do them in a dishonourable way. But Paul doesn't do that. He had the right motivation all along. Why did he have the right motivation? Well, I think it's because he wasn't insecure. He knew what God had assigned to him. He knew the gospel. He knew his God. And he went out on his mission. We look around, we see a world of religions, cults, trying to manipulate people, trying to force people into their ideology. And I believe it comes from a place of insecurity. I believe it comes from a place of people trying to prove that their religion is the right religion and trying to get people to conform to that, to prove that it is the right religion. But Paul wasn't like that. He wasn't insecure. He was grounded in the truth. He knew who God was. He knew the gospel. He knew the message. And he had love in his heart for people, a real love, a genuine care and love for the people that he was speaking to. So that's a memory shared. Paul looking back, remembering what happened when he went to the Thessalonians. It was fruitful. It was encouraging. It should be an encouragement for us as well. Sometimes when we're in 1 Corinthians, I think, man, like, it was there no good fruit? But there was in this church. So secondly, a message shared. Paul carries on to say, as we've been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak not to please man, but to please God who tests our hearts. When Paul came to see the Thessalonians, he had a message for them. He had a message that he'd come to share with them. What was this message? Well, it was simply this. I'm sure if we're all Christians here, we know the gospel message, but we need to go over the gospel message again and again. Never get tired of it, never get bored of it, but keep rejoicing in it, keep enjoying the truth of the gospel. There is a God. There is a God. We live in a culture that, for the most part, a lot of the people I come across, maybe they believe there's a God, but there's basically a secular agenda driving everything. The underlying idea that we see in the media is that there is no God. But the truth is that there is. The Bible teaches there is a God. And this God, he created the world as we see it, everything that's around us. And at the apex of his creation, the zenith, were human beings, us. He made human beings to have relationship with him, to live in this world, to enjoy this world, to steward this world, and live in perfect relationship with him forever. But those first human beings, Adam and Eve, our parents, they decided to walk out on God. They chose, rather than obedience, disobedience. And on that day, when Adam and Eve disobeyed God, the entire human race walked out on God. All of us. We're all just like them. Every day, I've been like them today. There's not a single day that goes by where any of us can say we've lived perfectly, where we haven't sinned. I know that today I've sinned against God. Today, on this day, as I've been preparing to stand up and teach God's word, I've still sinned. And we're all like it. We all have the same problem. The entire human race has sinned against God, walked out on God, broken God's law. And the result of that is that the entire human race is under God's judgment. We can see that around us, can't we? In Romans, Paul says that the wrath, the anger of God at sin, is being revealed now. We see it being revealed around us in the world, in its brokenness, the things going wrong left, right, and center, roller coasters crashing into each other, whatever it may be that's going on, aircraft disasters. Not to say that those disasters are a result of a specific sin, but a message is being preached. In all the suffering and things going wrong in the world, those things are preaching a message to us, saying God is, something's not right. Things have gone wrong. Things have gone seriously wrong. And it's God's wrath being revealed. And ultimately what happens, we all die. And we all know that that's not right. There's something wrong with the fact that we die. And the Bible teaches that ultimately we face God's judgment. We're going to have to answer for everything that we've done. What a scary thought. Every day that you've lived, we're accountable to God for, because it's him who's given us our life. And we can't even live up to our own standards. I know I can't live up to my own standards, let alone God's. We all fall short. We're all under God's judgment. Sounds pretty bad, really. Sounds like a bad message that Paul was bringing, but actually it wasn't. Because the problem's there, whether we believe it or not. But Paul was bringing a message of hope. Good news. We all know that things aren't how they should be in the world around us. No amount of religion can make it right either, can it? I was listening to Radio 2 last week. I don't normally listen to Radio 2. I listen to Radio 1 because that's much more cool. But I do quite enjoy Jeremy Vine. That's kind of a guilty pleasure, really, because I love it, because John in Bexhill rings up, and he's got the answer to everything. I think, John, if only I knew you, if only you were the Prime Minister, then everything would be okay. But unfortunately, John isn't. But anyway, I digress. I was listening to the radio, and there was a part on Jeremy Vine's show, and Orthodox Jews in London have been banning women from driving in cars. I turned to the apprentice next to me and said, "That's the problem, isn't it? That's what we need to do. If only we banned women from driving in cars, then the human heart would change. We wouldn't have any problems in the world at all." It's the same with religion, like with Islam. You've got ISIS going into countries trying to force their religious regime on people. Is it going to change anybody's heart? If people pray 5 times a day, is that going to change anybody's heart? It's not. Religion is not the answer. And that's one of the reasons why the religious authorities hated Jesus so much, and they hated Paul. Because the message that Paul was bringing, and the message that Jesus was bringing, and the person who he is, actually defeats religion completely. And shows us that we don't need religion. Because the very same God whose judgment we are under has come to us in the person of Jesus. We don't worship a God who sits aloof up in the heavens and expects us to be able to claw our way back to him, like in Islam. No, God himself has stepped into human history in the person of Jesus, fully man, fully God, and he's participated in the suffering of everyday life, the normalities of everyday life, work, relationships with other people. And he's taken God's ultimate judgment upon himself by actually experiencing going through death and dying in our place, taking God's judgment and wrath upon himself. So that by simply believing in him, just believing in him, just by God's grace as a gift, we can be 100% forgiven. We can be restored. We can have our relationship with God restored. And we can have an amazing hope of a new creation, a new world that's recreated in the world in the way that this world was supposed to be in the first place. No more suffering, no more dying, no more pain, no more sinning. We can live with God forever in peace and happiness. It really is good news, isn't it? It really actually is good news. I think I often lose sight of how good the news actually is, how good the gospel actually is, how exciting that is. We're forgiven. Like, if we believe in Jesus right now, we are 100% forgiven. We don't have to do anything to prove ourselves to God. He's done it for us. He's taken the judgment upon himself, being perfect, and he's given us his righteousness in exchange for our sin and rebellion and law-breaking. And he gives it to us as a free gift. That was the message that Paul says he was entrusted with. It was the message that he shared with the Thessalonians, and it was the message that they believed. Is that the message that you believe? And if it is the message that you believed and have been believing for a number of years, do you still preach that message to yourself, as it were? Do you still go over the message and digest the message and chew it over and enjoy the message and give thanks to God for that truth? Give thanks to God for giving himself to us in that way, forgiving us, and enjoy living as somebody who has been forgiven by God. That was Paul's message. That was the message that he shared. But he didn't just share the message. See, finally, a life shared. Seeing a memory shared, a message shared, and a life shared in verses 7 to 12. Because Paul didn't just share the message with these people, he shared his life. And Mark was talking about that church this morning. You know, the church where it's like a drive-through church. You drive up, wind your window down, hear the word of God preached, and wind your window up and drive off again at the end. I've said this before, I'm a natural born hermit. I quite like my own company. I probably wouldn't see another human being throughout my entire week other than Hayley and the kids and my customers, just because I'm a complete sociopath. So that kind of church actually sounds quite appealing to me, because I don't have to participate. I can just turn up, hear the preaching, and drive off. And aren't there so many Christians that do that? Not necessarily in that way, but maybe don't come into a church, don't become part of the body of Christ, but kind of go off and do their own thing, listen to Mark Driscoll sermons or whatever it might be, and think, yes, I'm living my own little Christian life in my own little bubble on my own. Isn't this great? And I'm tempted to think that way sometimes. Maybe you're not. Hayley totally balances me out, because she is the complete and utter opposite. She is, I don't know what the opposite of a sociopath is, but whatever it is, that's what she is. And she finds it very easy to go out and socialise with people, spend time with people, tell people the gospel. I find that very difficult. So I hope she balances me out. But for Paul, he shared his life with these people. He wasn't just some kind of religious guru who came along and told them this message and dispensed religious truth to them. He actually participated in just everyday normal life with them, as it would have been in Thessalonica in those days. I sometimes, for myself, I know that I can think that the gospel is just a set of facts. It certainly is facts. It is truth that we need to believe. But it's not just that. And sometimes we, or I can think, that to grow as a Christian, discipleship merely means getting people to believe the right things. And for sure, it totally is that. The Bible talks about renewing our minds. It talks about stopping believing lies and believing the truth instead. It certainly does speak in those terms. But it's not just that. Paul shared his life with the Thessalonians. He worked. He saw them on a day-to-day basis. He got to know people. And do we do that? Just in our little church here, our community that we're in, do we get to know people? Do we get alongside people? Or do we just turn up to receive the Bible teaching and listen to the Bible teaching, pray a few prayers, sing a few songs, and then go home and forget about these people who Jesus has also died for and redeemed? So easy to do that, isn't it? But Paul didn't do that. And Paul also, he didn't demand any of his rights. As an apostle, by rights, he could have demanded to be paid for doing his gospel ministry. But rather than do that, Paul was willing to let go of his rights for the sake of the gospel and for the sake of these people. He was happy to be inconvenienced by having to work hard at the same time as doing his gospel ministry. That must have been a proper full-time job. I sometimes complain about the fact I have to work and look after the kids, although Hayden does most of that, and then it's church on Sunday and it's just non-stop. But for Paul, it really must have been non-stop, because he's having to earn a living and do gospel ministry at the same time with these baby Christians who need all the help that they can get. He was willing to be inconvenienced for the sake of these people. Are we? I know that I'm often not. I'm not happy to be inconvenienced. And to be honest with you, as much as I enjoy Bible reading, I enjoy getting together with other Christians to read the Bible, sometimes I think on a Tuesday, oh, it'd be easier to just stay in and watch something. Not Big Brother, but something. It'd be so much easier to do that rather than have to go out and interact with people. But that's not the way to think at all, is it? That Jesus has died for all of us. We're community. And just like we were seeing this morning, we need each other. No man's an island, as somebody once said. Don't know who it was, because there was an argument about it about a boy about who actually said that. But no man is an island, are they? We can't just be doing our own thing. And Paul says that he was like a mother with her children. what's the difference between a teenager working in McDonald's and a mum making dinner for her kids? Well, the teenager, and I'm generalizing here, sorry to stereotype, but it's just this illustration. The teenager, he doesn't care about, if you go into McDonald's, he doesn't care about you. He doesn't care about the nutritional value of the food he's serving up. He doesn't care who's buying it, who's eating it. He couldn't give a stuff. He's just being paid to do his job. So he can go to Mali on holiday with his mates and get drunk. I'm sorry to break it to you, but those guys with the hats on and the smiles, they don't care about you. They really don't. Well, maybe some of them do. Maybe there's some good Christian workers in McDonald's who really care, but most of them really, really don't. Some less than others. But the mum who's making dinner for her kids, she actually really cares, doesn't she? She chooses ingredients, you hope, that are going to nourish and benefit her children. And maybe the children don't always like that, but she knows that that is what's best for them because she prepares the food for them out of love, because she cares for them. She wants the best for them. That's what Paul's saying here. I'm not just serving you up the truth for the sake of it and because it's my job and vocation. I really, really care about you. Like a mother taking care of her own children, verse 7. Like a nursing mother, a breastfeeding mother with a baby. Think of a baby. What's a baby? Passive, helpless. It doesn't know what it needs. It has no idea. But the mother knows what the baby needs. I tell you, I find the baby stage really, really difficult in having kids because you've got, you know, there's no formula for dealing with a crying baby. So Joshua's sitting on the floor, screaming his head off. Try feeding him, doesn't work. Try giving him a breadstick. Try putting the telly on, none of that works. Try holding him for a bit, still doesn't work. He's still crying. Put him back on the floor. Hayley, can you come and help me, please? Hayley comes in, picks up the baby in her arms, and he stops crying straight away. These were baby Christians, the Thessalonians. They literally only just become Christians. They didn't really know anything. They'd grown up probably on a diet either of Jewish religion or a diet of Greek mythology. They didn't know anything about anything to do with Christianity, to do with the truth of the gospel, other than what Paul had told them. And Paul was gentle with them. He was patient for them. He nurtured them and cared for them, taught them the word, just in the same way as a mother with her children. It's a beautiful picture, isn't it? But he wasn't just like a mother. Let's look at verse 11. He was like a dad with his kids. You know how like a father with his children, we exalted each of you, each one of you, and encouraged you and charged you to walk in a manner worthy of God who calls you into his kingdom and glory. So now think about a grumpy teacher with a classroom of unruly kids. I've got to be careful here because are there some teachers here? Possibly, yes. But think of that grumpy teacher with a classroom of kids. He doesn't care about those kids. This is just an illustration, right? He wants them to behave, but he wants them to behave because it makes his life easier and because that's his job. He corrects them, he disciplines them, but not because he cares, because it's his job. And if they behave, it makes his life easier. But then think about a father with his kids. He loves his kids with all his heart. And he sees it as his responsibility for his children to live the right way. So he disciplines them, he corrects them, and he guides them. But because he really, really cares about them. That's how Paul felt about these Christians. I think the paternal role is certainly more suited to me. That's probably a good thing because I'm a dad. But if the kids are acting up, I hear a call from the kitchen. Jim! Hey, Hayley doesn't speak anything like that. And then that's my turn to come and say, what are you doing? And the kids, they stop like that. It's not because I hate my kids. It's because I love them. I don't want them to go down the wrong path. I don't want them to drink the bleach or eat the dishwasher tablets or fall down the stairs or stick their fingers in the electric sockets, because I love them and I care about them. I want them to grow up to be loving people who think about others, not just themselves, but because I love them and because I care about them. That's how Paul felt about these Christians. And how easy it is for us to do the right things with the wrong motivation. How easy it is for me anyway. I mean, you know, I could stand here this evening and reel off a theologically correct, biblical, three-point sermon and not give a stuff about a single one of you, except my mum and dad. I always love my mum and dad. But I could be standing here, go through the formula, teach what the Bible means objectively, and not care at all. That's not what Paul was like at all. He really cared about these Christians. And so he didn't just spoon-feed them with the truth, which they needed, but he also taught them how to live the Christian life. So you see in verse 12 that we just read, "We exalted each one of you, encouraged you, and charged you to walk in a manner worthy of God." This wasn't Paul laying down a load of rules, you know, don't go there, don't watch that, don't listen to that, don't drink that, don't wear those clothes. No, this was Paul saying that the gospel message that I've shared with you is true. Jesus has died for you and he's delivered you from sin and its consequences. So wage war on sin. Whatever that might mean for us today, it's not a bunch of rules to be followed so we look like good little Christians obeying all the right rules. No, it's stop watching porn, stop getting drunk, stop gossiping about people, stop losing your temper, stop posting selfies on Facebook while you're driving your car at the same time. Live a life worthy of the gospel. Worthy of the gospel, worthy of that message that Paul shared with them. Doesn't mean a perfect life. It means a life that's lived where we're consciously thinking about that gospel that we believe. We're constantly thinking about the fact that Jesus has died to deliver us from sin. And so we realize that every day is warfare on sin. Every day, just like Jesus said, is one where we have to take up our cross and follow Jesus and die to self. But not just die to self, but be raised every day to the new life that God has for us, to a life worthy of that gospel. It's not self-improvement. It's dying and resurrecting, so much more than that. I love the way that Paul gets this paternal and maternal balance, because we need both, don't we? There is a place for patience and gentleness, isn't there, with baby Christians. You know, Paul didn't just come in and whack them over the head with a Bible. Well, I mean, he didn't have a Bible, but you know what I mean. The Bible hadn't been written there, because this is part of the Bible and it was still being written. But Paul didn't come in with a bunch of rules and religion, hit them around the head with it. He came with gentleness and care. He taught them the truth and trusted that God would change their hearts. But he didn't just do that. He also exalted them, taught them how to live in the light of that. And we need to get that balance. How to actually get that balance is a case of wisdom. I can't give you a formula for that. I can only tell you that we need both, and we need to pray to God for the wisdom. For you, that might mean as a mum or a dad, as a pastor or an elder, as a community group leader, or just as a Christian relating to other Christians. You're going to need both. We all default more to one than the other. I'm more of the paternal, hit people around the head with the Bible, whereas Hayley, for example, she's more the gentle approach. But you need both together. It's not the only place that Paul speaks in these terms of a father caring for his children. I've replied to himself or to God, but throughout the rest of the Bible, you see that image. Paul really cares for all the Christians that he ministers to, all the Christians that he teaches, all the Christians in churches that he's planted. He really, really cares for them. And if Paul really cared that much for those Christians, then how much more does the God care for those Christians to whom Paul has been sent? The God who's actually stepped into human history and died for those Christians. Maybe it would make our Bible reading easier if we really, really believe that. Because I sometimes come to the Bible thinking, God's cross for me. I've done wrong things again today. I haven't lived as I should have lived. I'll read the Bible. That will make it better. I'll do my little QT, my quiet time. That will rack up a few more brownie points with God. I so know that that isn't true, but I still default to that. But if I realised how much God loves me, and if we all realised how much God loves us, if Paul loved those Christians like that, how much more does God love us? Wouldn't that make reading the Bible and hearing from God so much easier, knowing that it comes from a place of love? God loves us, just like a father loves his children, just like a mother cares for her children. That's just a glimpse of the love that God has for us. But how can we be like Paul? How can we be loving? How can we have the right motivation? Because it's not like there's something that we can actually do. We can't change our hearts. We don't have the power to change our hearts. Why was it that Paul had this right motivation? Why was it that he loved people the way that he did? Well, it has been said that we become like what we worship. And I think Paul was the way that he was because he knew Jesus so well. He knew the gospel so well. He believed it with all his heart. He spent time with Jesus. He prayed to Jesus. He spent time thinking about and digesting the gospel, teaching and preaching it. And that changed his heart. It sounds like such a cop-out, doesn't it, to say we've just got to keep looking to Jesus. But it's true. It's true. That's what it comes down to. I know that's the answer that the kids are told in first words, but it's the same answer for us tonight, that we need to keep looking to, trusting in, believing in, relying on, living for Jesus on a day-to-day basis. That's what Paul did. That's how his heart was changed. That's how our hearts will be changed if we keep believing and trusting in that truth and living that truth. Amen.